Did you know that your gut is directly connected to your brain and can contribute to anxiety, stress, and depression, which, by the way, can also impact your sexual health? So here's my secret weapon for gut health, Just Thrive Probiotic. Now listen up. Just Thrive isn't just any ordinary probiotic. It is the only one that survives your stomach acid and reaches your gut 100% alive. All those others, the ones that come in fancy drinks or you gotta refrigerate, nope, that's not even a thing. This is the one. I've noticed significant changes to my overall health. Like, this might be TMI, but I'm way more regular and my skin is glowing. Think of Just Thrive like your personal gut gardener. It maintains the health of your gut by weeding out the bad bacteria that causes all those digestive issues and then replenishes the good, making it a total game changer for your digestion, your immune system, your skin, even your mood and sexual health. And if you want to check out my episode with Just Thrive's founder, Tina Anderson, we talk all about how gut bacteria plays a crucial role in your overall happiness, including your sex life. Because a healthy, balanced gut means less stress and more energy. So if you want to check it out, I'm offering a deal for my listeners. You can save 20% off site-wide at justthrivehealth.com with the promo code SEXWITHEMILY. That's 20% off on the probiotic that's truly changing lives and making waves in the wellness community. Everyone's talking about it. Don't just take my word for it. Try it for yourself. Go to justthrivehealth.com. Use promo code SEXWITHEMILY for 20% off. Imagine a toy so iconic it practically wrote the playbook for pleasure. Allow me to introduce or reintroduce you to the Magic Wand, aka the Cadillac of Vibrators. The Magic Wand Original is a trusted companion in the journey of joy, whether it's your first time chasing an orgasm or you're looking to give your partner a spine-tingling erotic massage. The Magic Wand should be your go-to with powerful rumbles and several different rhythms and patterns. It's no wonder the Magic Wand has scooped up accolades like Vibrator of the Year for decades. I'm so enamored with mine, I've customized my bedside table just to keep it within arm's reach at all times. But the magic doesn't stop with the original Magic Wand. The Magic Wand family has grown over the years, offering a variety of models to suit every lifestyle. Go cord-free with the Magic Wand Rechargeable. Embrace compact power without compromising intensity with the Magic Wand Mini. I love this mini. Or the Micro, which is just teeny tiny and really powerful. Or enjoy a range of sensations with the Magic Wand Plus. Each model delivers the same powerful orgasmic rumble that made the original a legend. So are you ready to experience the magic? Visit sexwithemily.com/magicwand and discover why the Magic Wand continues to enchant pleasure seekers around the globe. That's sexwithemily.com/magicwand. Magic Wand, more than just a vibrator. Sex with Emily. I'm Dr. Emily, and I'm here to help you prioritize your pleasure and liberate the conversation around sex. Today, I'm talking to Tana Amon. She's a New York Times bestselling author. She's the vice president of the Amon Clinics. She's a neurosurgical ICU trauma nurse, a renowned health and fitness expert. She's a two-time black belt, cancer survivor, mom. In her new memoir, The Relentless Courage of a Scared Child, you can get it now at relentlesscourage.com. It comes out January 5th. I found this book to be so relatable, and I so enjoyed our interview. Tana and I go deep into what it's like to write a memoir that involves revisiting all those traumatic experiences that shaped her upbringing. I mean, have you ever thought, no one's going to love me if they know the real me? If I tell these my secrets, they're not going to love me. But we're only as sick as our secrets. So we dissect the negative self-talk that a lot of us are just plagued with. And she walks us through her healing journey. Like Tana says, no matter what you've been through, you can work through it and come out even stronger on the other side. I think you're really going to enjoy this episode. Intentions with Emily for each episode. Let's set an intention together. So when you're listening, what do you want to get out of it? Well, it could be, I want to stop being afraid of showing people who I really am. Well, my intention is to show you what actually happens when you face your fears, you face your secrets, your inner demons head on, and you do the work to overcome them. All right, survey. We have a new survey. It's our Better Sex Survey, sponsored by Pure. And I just want to hear what you have going on now. What are your sex goals for the year? And a lot of you have been emailing me and saying, oh, thanks for your survey. I actually got me thinking about my own sex life and I learned something. So I would love if you could check it out. It's really easy to take. It is sexwithemily.com/survey. And I appreciate you. It really helps us make a even stronger show because I want to know what you like and what you want to hear. And just remember, if you have any questions at all that you want to ask me, just call me directly. It's Monday through Friday, 5 to 7 p.m. Pacific, and I can just help you take the next right step. It's like little mini doses of therapy. The number is 888-947-8277. That's 888-947-8277. All right, enjoy the show. What I thought was so great, your book, you were able to, you know, reveal probably for the first, sounds like for the first time,
yeah,
a lot of really deeply personal things that a lot of us have. And we wouldn't tell anyone. It's what holds us back. So congratulations on it. And I want to know, like, how did this book come about? Like, why now?
You know, I often say, if you don't want to heal yourself or your relationships, don't marry a psychiatrist. So Daniel, for some reason, Daniel, from the time I met him, just thought that I should tell my story. He thought that it would be helpful to a lot of people. And me, like many people who have suffered through or lived through, survived through a traumatic past, you know, was like, you're crazy. I'm never talking about this. I am never going to bring up my past. There's no reason for me to. I've done my healing. I've done my part. Why am I going to relive this? I don't need to do that. It was very personal. And also, there's a lot of reasons. I mean, I had a little girl and I wanted to make sure that before any of this came out, you know, she was of the right age. But eventually, over time, it just started to feel like the right time. I had a number of people through our platform say, you know, I look to you for inspiration because if you can do it, I can do it. And I'm like, wow, okay, that's saying a lot because I really haven't told them. I haven't said much. So I felt like I was almost not being totally authentic. Because here these people were looking to me for inspiration, but they didn't know the deep, dark stuff.
Right.
And it just felt like if they really needed that kind of support, maybe I should be really honest.
I mean, you really did. You revealed so much in here. I mean, it's like you talk about trauma in your home and having cancer and abuse, you know, emotional neglect and molestation and, you know, attack by somebody. And there's just so much gunshot wounds, having an uncle killed in front of you. I mean, there's a lot that goes on in here. So I was wondering, first off, the experience of writing the book must have been healing. Can you tell me about the journey of just writing it?
You know, it was. And one thing I'll say to people listening, if they've got a really, you know, intense story, if you think about writing a memoir, it's tricky when people are alive. So this is actually the very family-friendly version, as you might imagine, because most of the characters in my book are alive and they don't necessarily want their stories told. So I really tried to do it in a way where, you know, I paint the picture, but I don't get into the gory details of other people's lives because it was actually more colorful than it is in the book. And so when you say, and even my publisher said, wow, that's a lot to happen to one person in their lifetime. I'm like, this isn't even close to all of it. And here's the thing. People who go through trauma or chaos in their childhood, one thing I've learned about resilience, I did a lot of research on resilience. It's the sign of resilience. It's the sign of a resilient person to minimize what you've been through. So when I met Daniel, he kept saying, wow, okay, that's like, you've been through a lot. For a psychiatrist to say that, you know that that's probably not a good sign.
Yeah.
He's like, that's a lot of stuff that you've overcome. And I thought, no, it's not. I mean, I know people who've overcome more, right? I know people, I worked in a trauma unit. I know people who were chained to radiators for like their entire childhood or who were sex trafficked or, you know, and I would compare it to these like crazy, really out there situations, but that's a sign of resilience is people minimize something in order to make their situation not that bad or not as bad so that they can get through it.
Right.
And it wasn't until I sort of did my own work that I realized, oh, yeah, I've overcome a lot. You know, I'm kind of a badass.
Yeah, you are a badass. In some ways, I could really relate to a lot because I think that people are like, God, you're so resilient. You keep getting up. Is resilience in your research or what you found, what part of resilience is important for us to look at? Like, it is a trait, but it can also be kind of protecting us in a way from things?
Just, well, yeah. I think you just said it. I think it protects us, right? So people who are resilient, yeah, they minimize things. And maybe that's not always a good thing, right? There's a time that you want to address stuff. But there's a time to address things and there's a time not to address things. So there are some people who that's all they can do. All they can do is be stuck in their trauma. All they can do is be stuck in that victim mode. And that's not a judgment. It's just a fact. Some people are just really, that's all they can think about. And that makes it hard to move on and do what needs to be done. So that's sort of the opposite end of the spectrum of resilience. Right. Resilient people are like, yeah, I got stuff to do. So this is going to have to go on the back burner. This isn't as bad as it could be. They'll like minimize it and they'll move on. That doesn't mean they've necessarily taken the time to heal, right? But exactly. they'll bounce back. But for me, at least, there was a time when it's like, all right, now I feel safe enough. I actually want to address the root cause of this stuff. I actually want to move on from it. So it was necessary for me. I didn't want to feel like a victim. And at the same time, there came a point where it's like, all right, I'm resilient, but it's time to deal with this.
Okay. That's a great example because it's like, yes, I can keep being resilient for the rest of my life, but there's still something in me. So that's kind of what happened. I mean, I really love how you revealed, you know, so much of your journey. And then the point in your book where the healing starts, and a lot of it was through meeting Daniel. And it sounds like he gifted you the EMDR, which I've been in EMDR therapy for about 2.5 years. And is life-changing.
It is.
And so can you, so would you say that's a, because I'm always advocating for EMDR, but for you, do you think that's when the layer started to really, you started peeling back more layers, starting that
100%,
therapy?
100%. Okay. You know, Emily, you deal with a lot of people. You do a lot of interviews, even looking at you, you're this beautiful, successful woman. There are just some of us that know how to put on a facade, right? And I was one of those people. I had built this facade. It's like, just don't look under the surface. And in fact, I'm not going to let you. So it's like, you need to stay there because I've built this wall. I've got, you know, the paint, the hair, the makeup, the whole thing, the clothes. I was successful. So I was accomplished. In fact, perfectionism and accomplishments were how I sort of dealt with stuff. Mm-hmm. And so on the outside, even Daniel, when he first met me, was like, wow, you know, this is a good package. But I had to keep people at a distance in order for them to see that package. And that's when he started to realize, he's like, wait a minute, you keep people too much at a distance. And for someone who's psychologically savvy, they can see through that.
Yeah.
And so he kept nudging and I kept pushing back. And I broke his heart like several times because he's such a great guy. I didn't trust him. And that's one of the downsides of going through everything that, you know, if you go through trauma as a child, especially things like being molested or date raped or, you know, things like that, sexual trauma, you have a hard time trusting. Yeah. And so for me, it's like, I went to extremes. So there was a point where I felt very much like a victim as a child. And then in my 20s, I was like, I'm done. I am done being a victim. I'm done feeling like a victim. These things that happened to me are not my fault. They're their problem, not mine. But I went to an extreme. It's like, I need to learn how to play their games better than they do. It's a game. I got to win. And so I was like, let's just say I was fairly emasculating for a while.
Yes. It's just so common. I mean, I understand, like, you were like, okay, that's what happened to me, but now I'm going to drive. And then you accomplished so much.
Yeah.
I mean, working in a trauma unit. I mean, I have all your things here, like becoming a nurse. I want to say this right, though. You're a nurse. You became a
neurosurgical ICU nurse.
A neurosurgical ICU nurse.
Yeah.
So you were just kept going and getting the degree and you're like, I'm going to show them. And you did that. And
I did.
And yet then you meet this guy. What I love when I got to the part about you meeting Daniel, because I actually wrote down this quote and I really just took this moment. I go, this is what so many of us, including myself, get stuck in this place. And I thought it was beautiful because it's when you went to go see Byron Katie, who I'm a huge fan of her work. It's the work.
Yep.
And it's the four to five questions she asks you about your limiting beliefs. And I'm just going to cut to this part here. You said you're one of your greatest fears is no one would love me if they knew the real me. And then also, I can't love others because I'm afraid they're going to see the truth about me. And then I don't love me, which is why I can't accept the truth about me. And so I just want to say that I do believe that our universal truth is that we are going to be, many of us feel like we're going to be abandoned and we're not going to have enough love, and we feel that we're not lovable. And then it comes out and permeates everything we do. And in saying that, and you said it out loud in front of your partner and Byron Katie, like, to me, can you talk about working through that? I am not lovable. I have to hold these secrets in, because once I reveal my authentic self, my life will be over. I mean, you worked through that in such a beautiful way.
Well, there's so much shame that
I know,
goes
it's a lot.
Back so far, right? Because first of all, if you grow up in trauma and chaos, that's one layer. But then even just as young girls, we're so often taught, be polite, be quiet. We have our voice taken away in some way. Mm-hmm. So, you know, be a good girl. This generation is a little different. I certainly raised my daughter differently. Now we say she's either going to be the leader of a gang or the leader of the free world. We're not sure which one. Because I intentionally was like, I am not raising her to lose her voice in a dangerous situation. She needs to be able to speak up. If she's wrong, she can apologize later. But, you know, if she's in a dangerous situation, I want her to have her voice. And I never took that from her. So we just have to guide it. But we were not, most of us, especially my generation, I'm in my 50s, we weren't raised that way. And so you've got all these layers of how we end up in this place where we feel like we can't totally be our authentic selves. And now you, if you've ever been overpowered or felt overpowered, either by being molested or attacked or raped or any of those things, you start to feel like it's safer to be quiet. It's safer to be hidden. Or you go to the opposite extreme, like I did at one point, and it's like, yeah, I'm gonna be better at this than they are, and I'm gonna win this game.
Right.
And so I started to become the thing I hated. I became manipulative, if you will. And I kept men at a distance. So emotionally, I sport dated. It's like, I'm not getting close. You're not gonna get close to me. And I was actually honest about it at that level. It's like, look, I'm doing you a favor.
Right. You don't want this. Right.
You don't want this. And it was Daniel who went, yeah, no, I think I do. You need to let me make that decision. And he just wouldn't let it go, you know, but I kept waiting for the other shoe to fall. I kept waiting for, I'm like, nobody's this nice. He's not going to be this good guy. And he's the one that took me to see Byron Katie. He's like, I feel like you need to meet this woman. And it was so mind bending to find yourself in this situation. And she just turns your thoughts inside out. You know, if you've ever done her work.
Yeah.
It's mind-bending how it works. I did her 9-day workshop at one point, and you come out a different person, and you turn all your thoughts around, and you come to realize we don't see the world the way it is. We see the world the way we are. Mm-hmm. So if you are still living in this place of hurt, or you're living in this place of defensiveness, that's what you see. How are you going to make positive changes if that's where you are? And it was actually seeing her, that turnaround that you just read, was what then led me to believe I could finally do therapy. Before that, I was like, I am not going to a therapist, banging my head up against a wall for 2 years and telling you how screwed up my mom is.
Right.
That's not going to happen.
Exactly right. So, and I might have even jumped ahead here, because I think that was I wanted to get to that, but it is true. Can we just kind of talk about that? Because the reason why it really spoke to me is because, and you also went through eating disorder, and you said you sat down with Byron Katie, because this happened actually on my show last night. I have a woman who works with me, our intern, and we were doing a show, and she spoke up and said, she said, I don't love my body. I'm having a really hard time right now. I'm struggling through the quarantine. I've gained all this weight. And I actually had said to her, I'm like, well, what's your limiting? And I kind of tried to do with her, but it was sort of on the fly and she wasn't expecting it. But then I actually read through your chapter. This was just last night. I was like, oh, I want to read this part again. And it was just like, bam. And every woman on our Zoom for our show was like, I have that too. I have that too. And to overcome that body, you know, we're all going to have stuff we don't like about our body. But maybe you could walk us through that experience of going to Esalen, which I know I've been there. That's what I'm saying. I'm like, we are very similar in many ways. Maybe could we break that down a little bit about our limiting beliefs? Like I'm like not loving our bodies and how, I mean, there was the one part where you met Byron Katie and she said, how long have you had the eating disorder? You're like, whoa. You're like, how do you know? Right. Like what?
I hear I'm the queen of like being like perfect on the outside. Nobody knows. They all think I have it together. Even Daniel didn't know. Yeah. And so even he didn't figure it out. And so I just told him, and I thought he told her, and I mean, she just like could see right through me. Wow. And it was so shocking to me that she could just see right through me. And so,
yeah, let's talk through it. So you sat down and she was like, well, how long have you been dealing with this eating disorder?
Right.
And then you said, well, you know, first you're like, Daniel, you know, did you tell? No, she can just tell. And, you know, just, you got to understand the work from Byron Katie. We could put links right in the show notes, but how did it help you work through self-esteem?
So yeah. My limiting belief was, when I finally got to the turnaround, when I finally got to the root of it, it started out as nobody would love me if they knew me. It ended up, the turnaround on that was, I don't love me because I know the truth and I can't love others because I have to keep people at a distance because if I love them or if I love other people, they will see the true me. And so those were my turnarounds. And so that's when I realized, oh, wow, it's not them, it's me. But then from there, we went to Esalen. So that was, the first meeting was a separate meeting. We went to Esalen and she asked the one question, what do you hate about your body? And it just opened up this like huge, just enormous, just let me just say Pandora's box, if you will, with women in the audience. It was crazy. There were several hundred people there and I could just hear the craziness in the room. And at this point, I'm still not talking to anybody. I'm there perfectly made up. I mean, you've been to Esalen. It's like hippie.
You're like, I'm not talking to these.
Right. Exactly. And I'm like, I'm made up. I'm in, you know, I'm makeup, hair, the whole thing. Yeah. I'm like, I'm not talking to anybody. Like,
are not my people.
These are not my people. And so like, I'm not going to sit here and bitch, moan, whine, complain about all my issues. This is not going to happen. And so, and all of a sudden I could hear this woman in the back start talking about the things she hates about her body. And I, you know, when you just know by someone's voice, I'm like, wait, she's like significantly older than me, but I'm looking at my list and I'm like, but her list is identical to mine. Like, that's weird. So I turn around and she was, I don't know, maybe 300 pounds and she's much older than I am. And she's not well, she's like physically not well. Right. And I'm like, sort of in my prime. And I'm like, I'm confused. How is it that I have the same list as somebody who is older than I am, who's struggling with other issues, not my issues, different issues, but we have the same list. Then another woman's, and I'm like, now I'm getting uncomfortable. And then I'm like, I'm not going to say anything. And then another woman stands up and she's like, I hate my body and her list is similar to mine. And she's like, and I vomit my food. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm leaving this place. This is so uncomfortable because now it's just getting too close to home. I almost felt like people were going to turn around and look at me because she said it.
Right, right.
And then a third person stood up and she starts talking about how her husband left her for a much younger woman. And she's describing how the woman, you know, was in really good shape and she wanted to be like her and she wanted to learn how to manipulate men because if she could manipulate men the way this woman did, that she'd be able to manipulate him and he'd still be with her. And I'm like, okay, this is just way too much. All of this is just too much. And I ended up standing up because the woman she described sort of sounded like me. And I'm like, okay, this is so weird. All these three women from very different places, and their lists are almost identical. And so then I ended up standing up and reading mine. And it's the first time I've ever really stood up and opened up. And it was very sort of dramatic for me and crazy. And what I realized and took away from that is that we all hate our bodies the same. Our lists are pretty much the same. There are no new original thoughts. And to this day, whenever I'm coaching women, they have the same thoughts.
And let's talk about, it was like, if I only lose 5 pounds, I'm old, things are falling, my skin is sagging. Once I lose these 3 pounds, then I'll be happy. Then things will be great. If only I was a size 4, I think you were, when I'm a size 4 and they're looking at you, they're like, you are a size 4, but you still have your things. We're never happy with anything that we get. There's always going to be that thing. And so, I mean, and I thought, and I was with you on that. I was literally like how you were saying that you're like, I'm not standing up. And I've been in, because I've also been in so many workshops. I've done it all.
They give you some kind of like tea or something, like they put something in it.
Yeah, but I can't tell you how many times, Tanya, I didn't stand up. I'd be the one that didn't. So then you stand up. I'm like, in recent years I have, but then you stood up and you shared something and all the women just came around you. And it was just
I tried to run out of the tent. I'm like, I was so embarrassed. And now I'm trying to take it back. And so I take off, I run out of the tent and they followed me. Like several women followed me. And I had one woman come up and she said, you know, I've been struggling with an eating disorder for 20 years. And I realized when someone like you gets up and says what you said, it has nothing to do with my weight. It has nothing to do with how my body looks. I need to start looking for other answers. And she's like, if you're still struggling, because I told them all, I said, you know what? Guess what? I get up and kick my ass every day in the gym. I do all of these things. I have to accomplish more and more and more. And I put on this perfect persona, even though that's not how I feel, whether I'm sick or not. I do all these things. And guess what? I still wasn't good enough. My marriage still fell apart. It's not good enough. It's never good enough. And then that's when they said, oh, wow. Okay. Well, if you're not happy with yourself, then it's clearly not my weight that's the problem.
And if we don't love ourselves, how could anybody possibly love us? So I want to walk through this. So then you realize at that moment, I mean, I had that moment in reading it. And that's why everyone has to check out your book, The Relentless Courage of a Scared Child, How Persistence, Grit, and Faith Created a Reluctant Healer. I mean, that is such a powerful moment. So then from there, and I just want, I mean, everyone's going to read the book, but it just, maybe there's just more higher level points then, because then you realize, okay, I get up, I work out, I eat healthy, I look perfect because you are such a beautiful woman and you're so accomplished. And that's when the work started with the trauma therapy, kind of unraveling the trauma.
Yeah. And one of the things that inspired me, people always ask me, what is it that inspired you to get started with that? And you know, honestly, there was a moment that I looked at my daughter. I had a little girl, Chloe was 2 when I met Daniel. I had gone through a pretty awful divorce. And there was just something there. And I thought, you know, I'm not going to repeat this cycle. Mm. And I realized that I was putting band-aids. I was trying to like layer band-aids over a bullet wound and it was not going to hold. And if I didn't actually get to the root cause of this thing, I was going to repeat a cycle. I was going to end up doing the one thing I said I would never do, which is raise my daughter in a chaotic environment like I was raised. And that was really the big motivation.
And so you were able to recognize patterns that you knew. This is the problem. Most of us have these patterns that we don't even see. Like my mom always used to say to me, well, every generation is going to be better than next, but it's like barely, unless you do this work. Like maybe you are raised with a little bit more money and a little bit more security, but the inherent trauma is going to keep repeating. Don't go anywhere. We've got so much more to talk about after this break. There's nothing quite like sinking your teeth into a good sandwich. But listen, carb guilt is real. I'm someone who's very invested in my health, and I like to get my carbs from oats and beans and fruits and not bread. But I love bread. So here's my hack. Thanks to Hero Bread, you can enjoy your favorite bready delights without the carb consequences. Hero Bread has turned those carby, empty calorie bread products into fluffy, delicious breads that boast 0 to 1 net carbs per serving, 0 grams of sugar, and are packed with loads of fiber and protein. The first time I tried their white bread, I was skeptical. Could it really taste good with such impressive nutritional stats? Well, I'm pleasantly surprised to say it absolutely does. The texture is just phenomenal. It's like this soft, airy, and it just toasts up like a dream. I've whipped up everything from grilled cheese to PB&J and even made enchiladas, wraps, and tacos with their tortillas. Each time, Hero Bread has been a game changer. And here's the kicker. Despite its light texture and great taste, Hero Bread fits perfectly into my health goals. It's been adding more fiber to my diet while keeping the sugar at bay. Whether I'm packing a picnic lunch, planning a road trip snack, which I often do, or prepping French toast for breakfast, Hero Bread is my go-to. So whether you're craving a classic sandwich, a burger, or a hearty bun, or even indulging in a low net carb croissant, Hero Bread is something for everyone. And I highly recommend checking their monthly small batch drops out so you can try goodies like the 1 gram net carb Hero Cheddar Biscuit and so much more. You won't believe what they have. So you ready to kick carb guilt to the curb? Head over to hero.co and snag 10% off your order with the code Emily. That's Emily at hero.co. So how do we recognize trauma?
So, you know, I mean, trauma comes in so many forms. So, I mean, you have to be somewhat introspective. I think journaling often helps. If you're struggling in some area of your life, you might want to start asking yourself why you're struggling. And that's often a good question. It's like, why? Why am I feeling this way? Why am I struggling? I didn't recognize that I had trauma at first. In fact, I hated that word. I couldn't say the words that I had been molested. I just couldn't say it until I actually entered therapy. I think that so many people who go through trauma just can't sort of wrap their brain around that they were traumatized in some way until they actually, something happened and it sort of breaks the dam, if you will. So I think journaling sometimes helps you to remember some of the things that happens. Or, I mean, there's some people who are just willing. They're just willing to go into it. I wasn't one of those people. It's like, I wasn't that fast of a learner, if you will. My life had to be broken enough before I was willing to acknowledge it. It's like my rock bottom had a sub basement. You know? So I had to keep it.
You had to keep getting, right. You had to keep going, keep going. But it's never too late either, right?
It's never too late.
I think that we can always start. There's a lot of talk therapy out there, which is great in some ways to just start. But I do think there's something about the EMDR, the eye movement, desensitization, reprocessing. It is magical. Well, I was looking at something you said about it, about how it was like the pieces of the puzzle come together that you just didn't see before. And I'm wondering if that helped you in writing, because you have such great detail in your book. You remembered so many things. Was it through that? Was the therapy helpful?
Absolutely. So what would happen is there were moments where I thought, maybe I'm just not that smart. Maybe I'm not as smart as I thought I was, even though I did really well in school and I was accomplished and I had money in the bank and a house and, you know, but I thought maybe I'm not that smart or I'm just not that good at life, because I didn't really remember some of this stuff. There were some of the big things I remembered, but some of this stuff, like I started therapy and it's not that I didn't remember them. I did. I remembered that my uncle was murdered. I remember it vividly, but I never thought of it as a traumatic moment. Like, do you know what I'm saying? I never put it together.
Yes.
And I never put together that, oh yeah, by the way, I ended up going into the hospital and having upper and lower GIs 2 weeks later at 4 years old. But I never put together that some of my illness might be because of the stress in my home. Right. You know, I never put together, you know, that after being molested, like certain things happened in my life, or, you know, that the eating disorder developed after like a series of just stacked stressors. And I just couldn't kind of cope. Right. And I thought that maybe I just wasn't very good at life. Does that make sense?
Right. No, absolutely. You think you're stupid. I mean, I did that too. I held like, I'm not good enough. I'm stupid. I'm doing all these things because, and then you just keep trying harder, harder, harder. And then you're like in the hamster wheel.
Right. But when I started the MDR, what happened was, it's almost like a sweater unraveling. Like one thing, we're working on one thing and all of a sudden something would pop in my head and they ask you, so, you know, what are you thinking about? And I'm like, it doesn't make sense. Like some bizarre thought from when I was 9 just popped in my head. And they're like, no, there's no coincidence. What were you thinking about? And I would mention it. Like one of them was, I don't know. I keep having this memory of a time when my mom didn't come home. And I was like throwing up all night, and they're like, oh, and you don't think that's connected. And I'm like, oh man. And I started to go back. Like it started to connect to other things. And then pretty soon you're like, well, duh, I should have seen all of this is connected, but I couldn't at the time. And so I ended up connecting all of these things from way back. And I even had to call my mom and I'm like, you know, I just want to make sure my memories are clear, like that they're accurate, because right. I'm remembering things back to when I was 2. And she's like, how did you remember that? Like she actually clarified it.
Right.
And so it was really interesting how it just sort of like started to unravel all of this stuff. It's like, not that I didn't know it was there. It's that I just had sort of put it away.
Right. Right. And you can make meaning of it now, because what it sounds like is you realize through all these experiences, it was a series of traumas, which they call complex PTSD, which is something that I got that I didn't know I had. I've been in therapy for 25 years on and off. And it wasn't until the EMDR therapy that I even became acquainted with the term complex PTSD. I don't know if what they called it with you, but it was like a series of events that happened one after the next. So for you, it's like there were many very complex trauma. So and I think that's one thing. I used to just think trauma, you know, PTSD was war vets or, right. You know, one thing happening. But if it's a series of repeated events and then your nervous system, you know, and then that's how you start to react to things. You have the anxiety and you start just not being able to process life in the same way. So it's
I didn't want to have friends over. I didn't want to have people in my house because I didn't invite people from school, because I'm like, what crazy thing is going to happen today? Like you're always looking around the corner because you just don't know what crazy thing is going to happen. Who's going to be screaming or calling the police or throwing stuff out in the street? Or, you know, I mean, fortunately, you know, there wasn't murder happening all the time, but
just
like, honestly, you just don't know what's going to happen, you know? So it was just crazy.
Right. So then what we're talking about is through childhood, you had this chaotic childhood, which I think a lot of us can relate to chaos.
Right.
So all that, you don't never know what's happening. What's happening? Is your mom coming home? Is she not? There'd be nights because she was out working. So it's so easy to child say, well, mom's working hard for me. It's okay that she's not coming home and I'm 8 years old and scared in bed. But those things take a toll. And just because then you did a turn and said, okay, now I'm going to go to nursing school, I'm going to get my degree, I'm going to do all these things, doesn't mean that that part of us isn't still living us as a scared child who's waiting for mom to come home. So it's that disconnect where you're like, but I'm doing fine now, that it's going to carry us into childhood unless we start to unpack it through therapy.
Right. Well, and then to be fair, I mean, a lot of the trauma that happened when I was young, you know, when you're a child, you don't have control of it. But in my 20s, I made some bad decisions. So some of that was self-induced. But I think some of those bad decisions were a result of the environment I grew up in.
Yeah, I think it always is though, right? Like even though you were doing the right things, because I think it has to do with like your coping skills and your brain, how your brain can react to trauma. And you can have like a, you know, like I always think it's like the nervous, sympathetic, parasympathetic, always in, you know, fight or flight.
Right.
So you probably were still in fight or flight.
Always.
So can we talk about that? Because I know it's also the, there's so many cycles here. There's therapy, there's psychology, there's biology, there's, right. You know, I know that you exercise. I do that too. I need exercise to help me in the mornings, kind of ground. So what are some of the other things that you think have been really helpful for you to learn to love your body, love yourself, allow yourself to, you know, be in a healthy relationship?
So my husband calls me a seeker. So I'm one of those people who's always going to some, well now, I mean, seminars are harder, but even on Zoom, but I was always going to a seminar. I was always, once I finally acknowledged it, it's like, I was always searching for more. I wanted to learn more. So whether it was Byron Katie or Tony Robbins or therapy, or, I mean, I was always doing more. After I finally broke that dam, it's like, how much more can I learn?
Right.
And so I'm not a person who's really like can do one thing and just change everything based on that one thing. I'm kind right. of an all or nothing kind of
yeah.
girl. So it's like, I need the exercise, the eating, food really matters. It matters. You know, food affects your mood. What you eat, everything you put on the end of your fork makes a difference. Real food versus processed food makes a difference in your mood and how you feel and inflammation, all of those things. But also learning how to meditate and manage my mind, not let my mind just run wild with these crazy thoughts that were literally lying to me and ruining my life.
Let's talk about the people you spend your time with.
People you spend your time with. People are contagious. You know, if you're in a recovering alcoholic and you're hanging out in a bar, good luck. So, but the same is true with anything that you're trying to do in your life. If you're wanting to be very accomplished, you need, you know, the more you spend time around accomplished people, the more motivated you will be to do that. So, you know, that made a difference, changing my friend circle. And then mm-hmm. like, what gives your life meaning and purpose? Why are you on the planet? Because at one point I felt like I was wasting oxygen on the planet. I wanted to die. And so finding that purpose again, turning pain into purpose became just so critical. And it really is all of those things. And I have to do those things regularly. So I spend a little bit of time in each of those circles all the time.
Yeah. So it's the psychological, spiritual, social, biological, right? Biology. Like how's your biology? Yeah. We talk about like your hormones and all those things, like getting those things
head
checked.
Injuries. Yeah.
Head injuries. Yeah. Get your brain scanned at Almond Clinics. I did it. yeah, that's actually life-changing. But I think that's the other thing because, you know, going to Tony Robbins and doing all things is great, but then you kind of do have to do it all or at least have a consciousness around changing all these different areas of your life because it just doesn't work if you just become, because I went to Tony Robbins too like 6 years ago and I remember going and being like, okay, but there was more. I had to ground myself in the therapy and the spiritual. And so that's really.
Yeah, because otherwise it's like working out your bicep and that's all you do. You know, or you work out once and you never go back.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Tana, you know what's also I think is cool is that you're saying that you were anti-therapy until like your 30s, right? Real therapy. And I hear from people every single day. Typically, it's a couple and one person says, I want to go to therapy. Like my partner doesn't believe in it. They won't go. Or people just call in and say they don't believe in it. So what was that switch for you? Because you are a wonderful, shining example of somebody who was anti and then came around to it.
You know, as I said, a big part of it was I finally just felt so broken. I mean, I was finally at the right place to be, you know, to make the switch. But I had that moment with my daughter. My daughter, she had this crazy language when she was really young. So we often joke that Daniel, because he's a child psychiatrist, that he was that he was more drawn to my daughter because she had these 12-word sentences when she was two. But by the time she was three, she looked at me one day. She was about three when I went through this. And she looked at me and she said, "Mommy, people look at you different than other mommies." And I'm like, "What? Why is she saying this to me?" And she said, they look at you like you're shiny, like they don't talk to you. And I was floored that a three-year-old could see. To me, what she was saying, she could have been saying many things, but to me, what she was saying is she could see my facade. Like, that's what I saw. That's what I heard. And so it's like, she sees me being different than other people and people not approaching me. And so I was floored by that. Now, who knows? Maybe she was just saying, you know,
"Well, you're beautiful and people see you walking and you get out of there." But it struck a chord, right?
She's to this day, she's one of those, we say she's like a 45-year-old trapped in a little body. You know, she's just very deep.
I can imagine the daughter of you and Dr. Amen. It must be an incredible way to grow up. So let's talk about that facade, because like I always say, like, you're only as sick as your secrets, and the things we hold on to are what we think we can't.
I love that.
I took that from AA, yeah.
I love that. You're only as sick as
your secrets. And that's, well, when I was reading your book and I thought, yeah, that's, because you start out the chapter, you open up with like how you were at speaking in a jail, right? In a prison.
It was at a rehab facility, one of the largest in the country, that where they were ordered to be there.
Okay, got it. It's such a powerful story. I was like, I'm in. Because I was like, whoa, like you just stood up and people just saw you there to speak, more professional. And then you just kind of laid it down. You kind of revealed it. And I thought those are the moments, the things that we think we cannot say,
yeah.
You know? So it's really powerful stuff. And I think that peeling back the layers and there's so many things here. So you said your daughter thought you were like shiny. So that was part of it. That was part of it cracking, being like, I don't want to be this.
That was the first step. That was the first step, because I knew that I had always told myself I wasn't going to have kids. I did not want kids based on my background. And then when I hit my 30s, I was like, I'm ambivalent. And then I got pregnant thinking I thought I couldn't have kids. I had some female issues, thought I couldn't have kids. And I thought, oh, I can't have kids. Well, then surprise, I got pregnant. So right when I was going through a divorce.
How about that timing?
Yeah, that was really interesting timing. But all of a sudden I was really excited about it. It suddenly just shifted. And being a mom became the most important thing in my life. I was so bonded to this child, and to this day we are. I mean, Daniel jokes, we're just like attached at the hip. But I knew early on, I got really scared. I was like, I'm scared, because what if I can't do it? What if I raise her the same way that I was raised? I mean, my mom really did the best she could, but it was a mess. And so, I thought, I don't want to do that, but I was older and I was financially secure. And so I thought, you know, I have the ability to do it, but am I psychologically savvy enough to do it? And so that's when I decided, you know what, it's time. I was terrified for anyone to see what was underneath, to see those secrets. I was terrified, but it was worth it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember the first time trying to say, you know, certain things about myself or describe the situation when I was molested or date raped or, you know, all of these things. And there was so much shame around those things. And especially, you know, suffering like silently with an eating disorder.
Right.
So much shame. And one thing I will say is that once I put it out there, like now that I've got this book, it's funny. I sent my book in, my manuscript initially, and my publisher went, you know, I think there's a couple things you might not want to put in here. I was okay putting it all out there. She's like, I just think you're going to stir up trouble with certain people in your life. So we scaled back a little bit, but I was okay with it. And I thought, all right, you know, I'm going to let that be your judgment call, but I'm okay putting it all out there. And I realized after I did this that by doing it, even though I was scared to do it at one point, I'm like, you know, I've done my work, but I don't need to share this with the world. But then once I did it, I started to get so much positive feedback from women and even from men, like amazingly from men who had been traumatized in their childhood.
Yeah.
But I started to realize something. If you own the things that you think are the worst parts about yourself, by the way, it's just your thought. If you own that, there's no one else that can hurt you with it. If you own it, if you dive into it, what is anybody going to say? If you're okay with it, then how are they going to hurt you? They have the power to hurt you with it if it's a secret. Yes. They don't have the power to hurt you with it if you just own it. And so all of a sudden I just felt like, okay, well, what's anybody going to say now? They don't have to like me. I mean, right. It was a little weird at first, because if they don't like your nutrition advice, that's one thing. If they don't like your story, it's more vulnerable. But all of a sudden I thought, if they don't like it, that's okay. But it's not their job to like me, it's mine. And so suddenly I really embraced that. And it was like, I feel really strong about people criticizing me now. You don't have to like me. I wasn't put on the planet to be popular. I was put here to make a difference.
Wow. And you really are making a difference. I love the turning the pain into purpose. It's so true. The more that you were, and then you're like, I love that you're like, I'm going to even go all out and sharing all my secrets, and that your publisher's like, no, maybe not this one. You're like, take it all. Well, I'm very excited because they can get the book, you know, January 5th, The Relentless Courage of a Scared Child. But in the process of writing, how long did it take you to write?
Ha, that was a long process. that actually, it took me about a year and a half. Yeah, it took me about a year and a half to write it. Because, I mean, I've written books in 4 months. I've written 10.
I mean, you have a lot of bestsellers and everything, but this is such a different
path. So different. And I had to really, you know, you can't put your entire life into a few hundred pages. So it'd be a manifesto. And I had to decide which stories. And so I purposefully chose a certain series of stories for the intention of being able to help people. It was about overcoming. I didn't want to leave people with this feeling of sadness. I didn't want to leave them with just, I didn't need them to be voyeurs into my life for no reason. It was with intention that I chose those stories because I wanted to show people that it's possible to overcome no matter where you come from. And so that was the purpose. And so I had to write so much and then figure out which ones of those stories I was willing to tell. And when you get into some of the really hard stories.
What was the hardest one to write?
You know, being molested. When I was 12, it was being molested because my mom did such a good job of supporting me and believing me. And then right afterwards, I felt like she took my voice away. She told me to be polite and to him. And it was really hard for me. That was a hard story to write. I knew I was going to have issues with my mom for a while. We had to work through some stuff, but it ended up bringing us closer in the end. That one was hard, but believe it or not, the date rape and in my 20s when I wanted to die and then going on Prozac, because my behavior was so crazy when I went on Prozac, it was not the right drug for me. And that was not so much a matter of me being a victim to someone else's behavior. That was me just making bad decisions. Right. And so that just felt different. It was harder to write. It's like, okay, if I'm going to be honest, I'm going to be honest. Right. I just made a lot of bad decisions during that 8-month period of my life.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, but we do. We're human.
We all do. Oh my God. Yeah. All right. I'm going to take a quick break. There'll be more Sex with Emily. Thanks everyone for supporting our sponsors. You know, we only work with sponsors that we enjoy ourselves. And I hope you do too. Tana, tell me about how it's impacted maybe your romantic relationships, like your sex life, your ability to be intimate after that and how you've moved through it.
I think it affected it a lot. Yeah. So being intimate is really hard when you don't trust. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I got to a point, I also developed really young, which is why I ended up in some of the situations I ended up in.
Right.
I shouldn't have been in certain situations and I was. I got a lot of unwanted attention, if you will, not just from boys, right, but from men. Right. So it was a different era. We didn't have social media. It wasn't like you didn't see all these girls that looked like that. And so you got a lot of attention if you looked like that when you were back then.
Right. You say like a looker. Like, I mean, we're the same generation. So I understand that time. You walking on the beach here in Southern California in the 90s, 80s, I can imagine.
Right. And so you get this attention and I was really uncomfortable with the attention, but then you start to expect the attention and you think other people expect you to look that way. And so I began to need the attention I hated. I craved the thing I hated. Does that make sense? I needed
even though
I resented it. I started to not trust men. And it was, I mean, a big part of it, obviously, at 12 years old, my stepdad molested me and the story is pretty clear. My mom actually, she caught him and she physically tried to kill him. And that was very validating.
Yeah.
So for a while, I felt like I was going to be okay. Then there was the date rape thing that happened. And I felt like that was, you know, I think a lot of women feel this way.
Yeah.
I felt like it was my fault, or at least I questioned whether it was. And I wasn't even sure what to call it. I'm like, I was on a date with the guy. Maybe I should have dressed differently. I shouldn't have been there. And I started blaming myself because I think it felt easier to blame myself than to say I was a victim. It wasn't until I was much older that I'm like, no, he was a jerk. Yes, maybe I shouldn't have been there. but he was still a jerk. Like, it's like, you know, like we need to like, you need to learn how to draw those lines clearly. The being attacked on the street was just a fluke, weird, bizarre thing. I was walking to school and got pulled down an alley. Big white guy in a suit.
Yeah. And then you like kicked him in the balls, didn't you? Fucking like, you go, girl. I mean, really? Yeah. I mean, that's just all the things that happened to you. So then of course you didn't trust men.
I didn't trust men. And it just got worse. And so then I also was making bad choices. And I remember one turnaround for me when I started to finally get my life back together. I was talking to a friend of mine who's like my second mom. And I love this because she was so grounded, so spiritually strong. She had a huge influence on my life. I, you know, when the student is ready, the teacher appears. And I've had these amazing mentors in my life. And she was one of them. And she's a very strong presence in my book. And I was just complaining up a storm about what jerks men are, right? It's like, I'm trying to change my life, but the one thing that's still a mess is my relationships and men. They're just jerks. And she looked at me and she said, your problem is not the men you meet. It's the ones you give your phone number to. And I was just like, what? Wow. She's like, there are a lot of nice men in the world. You don't see them. Mm. And I was just like, unbelievable. And it really was the first turning point for me in recognizing that what she did with that one line was take me out of the victim mode. She switched it to where I was in control of it. It was empowering. Yeah, she was saying it was my fault, in a sense. It was my, or not my fault, it was my responsibility. But at the same time, it empowered me. It's like, well, if I'm the one making the choice, then I have the choice to choose better. So it just suddenly switched it for me.
That is, yeah, I actually highlighted that in the book because I thought that is such a big moment when whenever I hear people say, oh, every man's a jerk, every woman just wants a rich man or whatever, all of our stories.
Yep.
And then to realize they're just stories. There's a lot of single people. There's a lot of people on the planet. Not everyone is everything. In that moment, let's talk about that because I think a lot of people can relate to this feeling of like, everyone sucks. I've had 10 bad dates in a row. How do we know then who not to give our phone number to? I mean, looking at the patterns, like how were you able at that moment to see that like someone's like, you know, wasn't right for you? You know what I mean? After a year,
I'm going to repeat something I said earlier. We don't see the way the world, the way the world is. We see it the way we are. And that's actually, again, there's that word responsibility. It's up to you. When I coach people, this is one thing that I did with a couple of women that I coached. They kept complaining the same way I did. Their lives are in this terrible place. They don't have a good relationship. Men are jerks. So I had them write out their dream relationship detail, what he looks like, what job he would have, where they live, what his personality characteristics are. I mean, everything, pages. Then I stopped and I asked him, I said, so now tell me why this person would be attracted to you. And I didn't say that they wouldn't be. But I said, why would they be attracted to you? Tell me the qualities about you that they would be attracted to. In every single case, they got angry. And they said, they thought that I was attacking them. And I'm like, so why do you think I'm attacking you? Ugh. Because they, all of a sudden they stopped and they're like, because he wouldn't be attracted to me. I said, so if your dream relationship person would not be attracted to you, there's your work. It's not blame. Write down all the things about you that you would need to work on for this person to be attracted to you. That's your job. Like, there's your job.
That's your job. That is such an important exercise. And I just think I want to like everyone just to write that down, do it, because it's true. We are our own worst enemies. We hold ourselves back. It's a lot of it is our own beliefs about ourselves.
You're going to get exactly what you set your sights on. Your brain does not have a sense of humor. Your subconscious does not have a sense of humor. It does what you tell it. So you might even be thinking, well, I want someone like that. But if your subconscious is like, but this is who I am, that's what you're going to attract.
Right. Exactly. And so if you're saying, yes, that person would be attracted to me and I'll go look for them once I lose 5 pounds, once I get the degree, once this, that's all the stuff that's not the work we're talking about.
Right. Or if you're saying my fantasy guy is this, but I'm not smart enough, or right. I'm a loser, or we have so much angry, right. Negative self-talk about ourselves. And sometimes you're not even that conscious of it. You need to be conscious. You're not,
right.
Because your subconscious is going to do exactly what you tell it. Mm. You know, yes. And I'm just going to be, probably make a lot of people really angry right now, but I'm just going to say this. if you are in that place like I was in, where you're just very emasculating and you're manipulative because you don't want to be hurt, good luck trying to find a good guy. Like it's, they can spot that a mile away. I went through that phase of like, I don't want to be hurt. So I'm going to be better at this game than they are. And I, quite frankly, was. I just was.
Because you, right, you're like, I'm going to be an A-plus with every student, with everything I do. And right. You were that, so that is sort of, okay, so let's talk about this because we're, there's a lot of women now I see, and they're, you know, a lot of our listeners too, in their 20s, and they're like, oh, I'm just going to be like a guy. I'm going to have sex like a guy, or I'm going to play the player. This is going to get you nowhere. This is not the work either. And so I think there's sort of a trend towards that. Like, I don't want to catch feels, and I just want to sleep around, and I'm not going to show my cards because I'm going to get taken advantage of. And then that's what you're leading with. There's no
way.
That's
what you get back.
That's exactly what you get back.
You're not going to. So then when you go, all guys are jerks, well, why would a nice guy be attracted to you?
Right. No, I think that is so powerful. Tana, this is so good. We need to hear this, especially from someone, you've been through it. You know, you've done all the things to get to a place.
So one of the things before this book came out, I'm like, I need to have a talk with my daughter. She's very mature, but we need to talk about all of this stuff. So
good. How has that been?
Oh, she was so great. She actually like sat down with me, and she's a really amazing writer, and she even helped me with little parts of it. She got really involved. Mm. She's awesome. But I told her, I'm like, you know, honey, I go, there's just nothing I haven't either done, said, heard, or thought about that you can surprise me with. Like, there's nothing that I haven't, you know, done one of those things. So anything that you come across, you can talk to me. Trust me, I've lived enough life. And so I started telling her, I'm like, look, when you go into high school, this is what's going to happen. Like, these are the lines. This is what's going to happen. I want you to be aware. I want you to be grounded in yourself as a person so that you're not vulnerable to these things, so that you look for the right qualities in a person when you start dating. And she's like, that's not going to happen. And then she came home. She's like, Mom, I can't believe it. How did you know that was going to happen?
So what are those things to prepare young people, you know, go, for example, like.
Yeah, well, I mean, now it's very different than we were kids. And when we were kids, it was bad enough.
Right.
But now, I mean, like so many of the kids going into junior high, they're looking at porn on their phones in school. And so girls get really, really insecure because they're like, that's what I'm supposed to be like, right? And so, and the language around what girls are supposed to be like. And so I really prepared her. I'm not of the mindset that I should shelter my daughter from the world. Because of what I went through, I'm of the mindset that I'm not raising my daughter to look for a prince. I'm raising her to look for a sword. Like, she needs to be prepared. Mm-hmm. So she needs to just take it on. So that's how I kind of raised her. And so I want her to know what she's up against. Right. The reality of it. And so I told her that's what was going to happen. I'm like, look, you're going to hear stuff that you haven't really heard. She didn't have my life, right? So she hasn't heard that stuff. I'm like, but you need to know now because you're going into high school. You're going into her high school is like actually junior high and high school. And so I'm like, I probably wouldn't have told you this soon if you didn't have social media and your school wasn't this far advanced. But one thing that I found, there's a book that came out, and I know you know of it, a while back called The Game.
Yes.
Somehow these boys are still getting this information, right?
I have nieces who are in high school. Yes. It's terrible they're getting this information. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Neil Strauss, The Game. Yeah.
I'm like, if you are going to be up against this, because she came home and she spouted off a couple things, and I'm like, oh, dear Lord, they're like literally just regurgitating The Game.
The negging, right? Where they like, oh yeah. Like that kind of stuff. Yeah.
And all that kind of stuff. And I'm like, they are regurgitating The Game. And I'm like, all right, sweetie, you're going to be armed and prepared and aware. So I just went through it with her. I'm like, these are the strategies. These are the games they play. And I'm like, I don't want you to play these games. I want you to be aware of them. In martial arts, I practice martial arts. I'm a huge advocate. I love it. After being attacked, I'm like, I want to be empowered. And I'm like, look, we actually try to avoid fights. Like, I wanted to learn how to hit stuff really hard when I started training. I just like wanted to learn how to hit hard. And my master was like, really, you're going to go up, you know, blow for blow with a 250-pound guy? I think not. I think what you want to do is be armed, prepared, aware, run really fast anytime you can. Only when you can't do you want to be able to fight and just get one good shot in and then run. And I'm like, oh, that's probably a good point. I really don't want to go blow for blow with a 250-pound guy when I'm 120 pounds, right? So the point being, metaphorically, is that you don't play their game. You want to rise above it. I'm teaching you this not so that you can do what I did, be an idiot and be better at their game. I'm teaching you this so that you can avoid this game, so that you can spot it, because those are not the guys you want to date, because you haven't messed up your life yet. You haven't made those mistakes that hurt your soul yet. Okay. So the more that you're able to avoid, guess what? If you do, when you do, I'm here. It's okay. They're not fatal, but you haven't yet. So if you can be aware and avoid those things and pick someone who shares your values, is grounded, and because she's a pretty grounded person, you're going to save yourself a lot of pain. If by chance that doesn't happen, then come back to me.
Yeah.
You know, I'm here. It's not fatal. I promise you.
Yeah. You're doing good. You're right. We got to point this out, but sometimes they don't want to listen, you know, to their mothers or everyone else is doing it, but it sounds like you were laying it down. And yeah, you also, you're a double black belt. We have so much to talk about here.
A black belt in Taekwondo and a second degree in Kenpo Karate.
Gosh. I mean, you've done so much, and I love your book. And I think that people could learn so much from the relentless courage of a scared child and all of the work that you're doing. How has writing the book and now revealing these secrets, I know it hasn't even really come out yet, but you did the hardest work by just writing it. Have you felt a shift? Have you felt?
Yes, huge shift, actually. So the couple of things that I revealed, even on social media, because I thought, oh, I wrote the book, but I'm not really going to say it on social media. And a couple of things that I put out on social media, I got just the opposite response of what I expected. Women just flocked, and they were like, it makes me feel, I even was getting private messages from like really big influencers, models, going, wow, I so needed to hear that. You have no idea how much I'm struggling. And just so many women coming forward saying, you don't know how much it helps me that you're being so vulnerable and so open and so honest. And that just encouraged me more. And I thought, you know what? This is what people mean when they say it sets you free. Mm. That vulnerability sets you free. It sets you free. Exactly. And now I actually feel more just impenetrable to criticism.
Right. Now, to me, that is such an incredible reason just for everyone to start, you know, not all willy-nilly. I don't mean to go post all your secrets on Instagram, but I'm saying, like, start doing the work, whatever that looks like.
I think you have to use discretion, right?
Yes.
We don't throw our pearls to swine. You don't throw everything out there to people who aren't going to, when you know, there's a certain, you have to use discretion over things that probably you shouldn't talk about. You have to know when and how much.
Well, that's another lesson too, because sometimes people are like, okay, Emily, I started telling people my fantasies and I told them everything. I'm like, on your first date, like, I didn't say that. I just said we should be open and we should reveal things, but I'm not saying, you know, we got to know that too. But I think therapy is a great place to start. You have so much courage and resilience, and you're just so admirable. And I'm so grateful you were on the show, and congratulations on your book. And now I'm going to ask you the five questions we ask all of our guests, are just quickie questions. And you can answer however you want. They're super quickie. Okay. Biggest turn on.
The total safety and intimacy in my relationship.
Biggest turn off.
Pretty boys who spend more time in the mirror than I do.
What makes good sex?
Safety, intimacy. Like true intimacy.
Something you would tell your younger self about sex and relationships.
Wow. How long do we have? stay authentic, stay grounded. Just don't play games. Don't play games just because other people are.
What's the number one thing you wish everyone knew about sex?
That it's powerful, that it has the ability to hurt people if you use it incorrectly, if you're manipulative.
Thank you so much for being here. Okay, The Relentless Courage of a Scared Child. They can find it at relentlesscourage.com.
Yes, and there's gifts. We've got a whole bunch of gifts for people.
Ooh, I love gifts. And your YouTube channel is fabulous. We'll put all this, but your website?
TanaEamon.com. And yeah, the book comes out January 5th, but we've got pre-order gifts, so.
I love the Almond Clinic, all the things you guys are doing there. Super impressed, because I've gotten to know your husband in the last year, and you know, he's helped me so much and so many others. Both of you are. I remember when I met him, he said to me, he's like, you should meet my wife. Like, and it's
he said that
it's
to
so
me
glowing.
Too.
It's so glowing, but there's so many, you know, in the world, men you meet who aren't like leading with their wife. And it was like, one of the first things he said. And I don't know. Now that I feel like I know you because I know your whole story. And I was like, they are so well matched.
Oh, he's my best friend. I mean, and he is what you see is what you get. So it's so interesting because I kept thinking no one's that nice. He's actually that person, the person you interview, the person you see on stage. Like he's that person, only he's even kinder and more my rock at home. Like he's just, yeah.
Oh, I love it. I love it. I love learning all about this. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much, Emily.
That's it for today's episode. See you on Wednesday. Thanks for listening to Sex with Emily. Be sure to like, subscribe, and give us a review wherever you listen to the podcast. And share this with a friend or a partner. Believe me, if you got something out of it, they will too. We release shows on Tuesdays and Fridays, and look out for a bonus episode every now and then. Find me on Instagram, YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter. It's all at Sex with Emily. And I've been told I give really good newsletters. So sign up at sexwithemily.com and don't forget to check out our blogs. If you want to talk to me, ask your questions about your sex life, dating, or relationships, email me feedback@sexwithemily.com or call into my SiriusXM show Monday through Friday, 5 to 7 p.m. Pacific, and call me, 888-94-STARS. That's 888-947-8277. Get a free 30-day trial at sexwithemily.com/SXM. You can watch my masterclass on masterclass.com/Emily Morse. Was it good for you? Email me, feedback@sexwithemily.com.